Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
We are quickly approaching a point in human history where there will be more people who have something embarrassing or humiliating in their Google search results than people who do not. All right, that's an estimate. But what is a fact is that putting someone's name into a search engine is by far the most common way to find out more about them. So people who have dumb, youthful indiscretions in their past, people who have criminal charges for which they've since paid their debt to society, or even people who were past victims of cyberbullying that has somehow stuck around the top of their results. In Canada, those people are mostly out of luck, but not everywhere. The European Union, for instance, has legislation that offers them a chance to request that those results disappear. It's called the right to be forgotten. But who gets to exercise that right? And who decides if a piece of information is suitable to remain on Google or not? In Canada, what options do we currently have for delisting the worst stuff that exists about us online? And should we even be allowed to do that? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Michael Geist is a law professor at the University of Ottawa, and he specializes in, among other things, online privacy issues. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I'm really happy to do this.
Perfect. Well, can you define for all of us, first of all, just what the right to be forgotten online means?
Sure. So, I mean, I think the starting point for the right to be forgotten is the notion that there may be content online that we would like to have forgotten or to be forgotten, that it may be truthful, it may be accurate, but it can be embarrassing. It can be even more than embarrassing. It can cause real harm to our reputation. But it's difficult to remove it because there's nothing inaccurate about it. There's nothing unlawful about it. And in fact, by and large, it's often would rest undiscovered, but for search engines that make it easier to find content. In a sense, the internet never forgets, in part because of search engines. And so the idea behind the right to be forgotten is this right that people have to ask that information be removed largely from search engine indexes so that the information may remain online, but will be very difficult for others to find.
And when we talk about a right to be forgotten, where and where not are we talking about a legal right? Like, can people actually do this and where it's enforceable?
So the place that gets the most amount of attention, or the jurisdiction that gets the most amount of attention around this issue, is within the European Union.
Right.
And many of your listeners may know that Europe has adopted fairly forward-looking privacy regulations. They refer to them often as data protection rules, and they go beyond what's found in many other jurisdictions. And all of this kind of arose out of a case a number of years ago where someone in Spain had a newspaper article that had been posted many years earlier involving some legal issues. He found it through Google. He wanted to have it removed. He asked Google to remove it because, as I say, it was difficult to actually remove the underlying content. Google said no. The case went up through the European courts, and ultimately the court interpreted existing European law to allow for Europeans to ask for content to be removed from search indexes. And so Google proceeded to abide by the ruling and set up a structure whereby people can ask for certain search results to be removed, in a sense, have certain information removed from the index itself.
So how does that work in practice? Obviously, they don't have to remove it. So presumably there's a person or a jury almost there somewhere deciding whether or not, I guess, this is embarrassing enough or long enough in the past to warrant no longer being the first thing that pops up when someone Googles you?
Right. They've adopted a fairly detailed, prescribed system to deal with this. And some would argue they do have to remove content, at least content that falls within the strict structure of the law from their index. So the way that they do it is that there is an online form that people can fill out. They can identify the URL or the web address where the content is located, provide the reason that they believe that it ought to be removed. And they've got essentially a triage system in place whereby they get a first round of review. Someone will take a look at this, decide whether or not they agree with the claim that's being made by the individual. Sometimes they remove the content. Sometimes they take a look at this and say, no, I don't think that this really qualifies. And other times they say, this is a pretty challenging issue. It's not totally clear cut. There are arguments on both sides. And so in a sense, the URL or the claim gets escalated to others who may be asked to conduct their own review. And these issues can get slowly escalated within the company until ultimately there's a final decision maker who can make the call whether it stays in or out. Depending on that decision, if the company says, no, we're not removing it, then it's open to the individual to file a complaint with their data protection commissioner arguing that Google is not in compliance with their obligations to the right to be forgotten.
Do we have any idea, since this process was put in place, how popular it's been and what people are using it for? Because I feel like there's such a wide spectrum of things people might really want to be forgotten online.
We do. And Google has some numbers that are out there. We are talking about hundreds of thousands of URLs that have been removed from their index since this was put into place several years ago. So we are talking about something that's pretty widely used now. And when you talk to people at Google, they'll tell you that there really are these kind of three buckets of cases. There are those that are no-brainers in the sense that, yes, it clearly ought to be removed. It's causing harm. They can see why it would cause harm. The information itself may be accurate, took place years ago. But for whatever reason, it ought to be removed now. Then there are those that they say, well, no, we're simply not going to remove it. A competitor doesn't like something that someone else is saying about them. And they say, sorry, right, that's not good enough. And we're not going to remove that. And then there are the really hard cases where there may be public value in continuing to have access to this information. There may be some amount of harm. And I think troublingly to a lot of people, we ultimately then put the decision in the hands of a large intermediary like Google that has to weigh these competing views and ultimately make a call. And so by having a system that largely takes this out of the hands of kind of entities that we would traditionally look to conduct these reviews, for example, a court, we're vesting actually a considerable amount of power in a company like Google.
And we're going to get to how that applies or doesn't apply in Canada in a minute. But I guess my obvious question then is, how does Google feel about that, being the sort of judge, jury, and executioner on these things?
Well, they certainly opposed the case or the case as it proceeded through the European court. But once they were left with no alternative but to comply with the law, they obviously did so. They have continued to engage in cases that may prescribe or circumscribe, I suppose, some of the limits of the law. So, for example, there was a recent case out of Europe that raised the question as to whether or not the removal of the results from the search index should be limited just to people within Europe, or was Google obligated to remove from the search index the results on a global basis?
Huh.
And so Google unsurprisingly argued, if we've got to comply with the law, the compliance ought to be limited to the European borders. The idea that somehow Europe decides for the rest of the world what comes in or out of a search index seems inappropriate. And a European court actually agreed with them. They said, you're right, the way the law is constructed right now, the limits are within Europe, although it's open to a specific country, individual country, to say, we'd like to see it extended further, and then they could take up a review of that kind of law in the future.
I don't even think that many people have an idea that Google results can be so different country to country.
Yeah, they can. And this actually came up in a Canadian case a couple of years ago, a case known as Equistec, where a British Columbia court issued essentially a takedown or a removal from the search index. It was coming out of an intellectual property dispute. And the question that ultimately went to the Supreme Court of Canada was whether or not a Canadian court order could require a company like Google to remove search results, not just for those accessing it in Canada, but those doing so on a global basis. And interestingly, the Canadian Supreme Court ruled in that case that they could issue an order that would be applicable on a global basis. So we're starting to see some differences of opinion, in a sense, between high courts around the world about how far their rules, their orders ought to extend. But from the perspective of a company like Google, they do have the ability to limit search results. It may not be 100% perfect, but you know, Canadians seeking to access Google typically will find themselves at the google.ca site, and the results that they get are going to be tailored somewhat for a Canadian audience. And so they're going to reflect what Canadians typically may want to see, or based on their algorithm, may obtain somewhat different results than someone, say, in Europe or the United States, or as has attracted a lot of attention, someone trying to access the search engine from China.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
I guess that brings us to Canada, and I understand that it doesn't follow the exact same framework as the European Union, but where does the right to be forgotten stand in Canada? Do we have any legislation that covers it or offers an opportunity for someone to make a request?
I think the answer depends on who you ask.
Interesting.
I would say that before the European decision came out, I would say that most would have concluded that Canadian privacy law in the way it is currently structured, does not include a right to be forgotten. There's certainly nothing specific about a right to be forgotten within our privacy rules. They date back to the late 1990s, is when our private sector privacy rules were first introduced, and they took effect in the early 2000s. There's nothing directly on point that deals with the right to be forgotten. But in recent years, the Privacy Commissioner of Canada has sought to interpret the law to say that he thinks that there is a right to be forgotten, or at least that he can interpret that there exists a right to be forgotten within the law. Not everyone agrees, and it is currently before the courts, who are starting the process of sorting through whether, in fact, you can interpret existing law to include one of these rights, a right to be forgotten. Although I think some who look at the Canadian privacy law space expect that we will review and update our laws probably well before this particular piece of litigation kind of winds its way through the Canadian court system.
Is the right to be forgotten a popular idea in Canada? And I guess if it is, why haven't we heard a lot about it from federal politicians, especially now?
Well, I don't know if it's a popular idea or not. I mean, I don't know that we've seen a lot of survey data that would indicate whether or not it's popular or not. We're certainly in the midst of a time when there's a lot of people speaking out against some of the large tech companies. So something that seeks to regulate some of those companies may have some amount of popularity, depending, I suppose, on who you talk to. I suppose the reason that we haven't seen politicians move forward with this, I think, has less to do with whether or not it's a popular idea or not. I mean, I think that we're still at early stages to identify whether it is or not, and to educate Canadians about this particular issue, and more about how slow privacy reform has proceeded in Canada. So that the Liberal government did produce a digital charter, what they call a digital charter, towards the end of their mandate, that does talk about reform to Canadian privacy law, including these kinds of reforms, but it came fairly late in the mandate, and so there's been no legislation that's been introduced. I think that we've got all the political parties talking about privacy reform. I think in light of the Facebook and Cambridge Analytica case, these issues have gotten a lot more attention. And so there is an openness to reform. It's become a bit more of a legislative priority, but it's fair to say it was not a big priority for many years under the Liberal government. It certainly wasn't under the Conservative government before them. So we've basically had a law that was introduced more than two decades ago, which can be adapted through interpretation, but it would hardly be described as best of breed or modern in light of some of the things that we've seen take place and some of the laws passed elsewhere. And so reforms, I think, in the view of many, are now long overdue.
As someone who deals with this stuff every day, what do you see as the future for this kind of legislation? Do you believe we'll have something specific governing this rather than trying to interpret old laws within the next little while?
Well, I'm certainly an optimist that we're going to see privacy reform in Canada. I do think this issue has kind of moved up, and we've reached the point where whoever forms government will, I think, seize on this as a way to address what is mounting public concern, and I think a recognition that there is a need for update. At the same time, there is also a sort of a political trade reality that Europe has updated their laws, and they've long had in place a system known as adequacy, whereby they can restrict the ability to transfer data across borders only to those countries that meet a certain standard. The standard being that they've got an adequate level of privacy and data protection safeguards. Europe says for itself whether or not a country meets that adequacy standard. Canada received an adequacy finding, in effect, many years ago when it first passed its law. But given the amount of change that we've seen in the world around privacy and specifically in Europe, as Europe reviews the Canadian adequacy finding, even more than the Canadian public saying they want to see changes, if Europe says we may withdraw the adequacy finding for Canada and thereby put at risk a lot of those data transfers between Canada and European member states, that may provide, I think, even the strongest impetus for whoever forms government to re-examine Canadian privacy law and update it for 2019-2020.
On a practical level, given that Canada doesn't have a process in place for this right now, what do people who find themselves with a URL really high in their Google rankings that could cause them a lot of problems typically do?
Right. Well, let's start by noting that the starting point for many would be to see whether or not they can get the content removed at source, which is really the issue. At the end of the day, this is trying to obscure the information as opposed to have it removed altogether. So probably the starting point is to say, well, how can I find a way to get this content removed from the original source? If they're unsuccessful in that regard, there are services out there and people that work to change what comes out as part of a Google search result. So in a sense, try to move it further down the rankings, since we know from many studies that most people don't go beyond the first set of results that they get from a search engine. And so if they can find ways to have other information about themselves become more prominent in those search results, the information still may exist in the search result, but fewer people may see that link and decide to click on it.
Is there a slippery slope argument to be made when we're talking about this in general, in terms of letting third parties and not the courts determine what is seen about us online? I mean, somebody could have an interest that concerns Google and they could decide not to de-index it for that reason, right? I mean, I try to grapple with all the possible requests from this, and it seems massive.
It does. I think there are a lot of problems with the right to be forgotten or the right to de-index. I think from a Canadian perspective, I think we ought to recognize first and foremost that we have a different constitutional structure than those European member states. And once you layer in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms and rights to access information and the protections for freedom of expression, the notion that somehow we can simply remove access to this information and have something that remains charter compliant, I think is a challenge. Now, that's not to say that a court might not uphold a provision that is well-crafted, that addresses some of the safeguards that might be necessary on these issues. But Canada is not Europe, and it is not by any means clear that we can simply import the same rules that they have in Europe and still be compliant with some of our fundamental laws around the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Even beyond that, there is, I think, an open question as to whether or not this is a good idea. I think that access to information is critically important. And the notion that someone can, in a sense, rewrite history by making this information very difficult to find, information that as we've been saying, is accurate. There's nothing unlawful about it. I think raises some real legitimate concerns.
It's funny because when I think about this, I come at it from like two perspectives. On the one hand, I totally understand, just as a private citizen, having something about you online that's really embarrassing or humiliating or would hurt your business or career prospects and wanting it removed. On the other hand, as a journalist, I rely on looking that stuff up, exactly that stuff, to find out stuff about people.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think these issues, broadly speaking, certainly about this, but even more broadly about the role that large intermediaries like search engines, social media companies play with respect to access to content, are incredibly challenging, far more so than I think sometimes you get it's part of popular discussions where it's simply like, well, we should require these companies to do more. They ought to take responsibility for the content on their system. But by requiring some of these same large companies that we're already have some amount of concerns with about the kind of power that they're able to exercise around information, putting it in their lap to make these kinds of decisions, whether around the right to be forgotten or around even more broadly content moderation, what comes up, what comes down, in effect makes these companies even more powerful. And by doing so without more traditional due process and court oversight, I think that raises a lot of real problems and real concerns that in many ways, these kind of weighing these different policy goals and sometimes these legal obligations are really best left to courts that are better positioned to engage in that kind of analysis. The challenge then becomes, how do you scale to a point that's fast enough and large enough to address both the massive volume and the need to respond quickly to some of these concerns in a court system that isn't known for handling things particularly quickly, nor is it well positioned to deal with the large volume that we're thinking of?
I usually end these things by asking the expert where you think we'll be on this in 5 years, but it feels like this is changing too fast to even go there. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't know that we've got a good sense of where we're going to be at in 5 years. We don't have a good sense where we're going to be at in 5 weeks, given that we're in the midst of an election campaign and we've got political parties in Canada taking different positions on these issues. I think the one thing that we do know is that these issues aren't going away, that we are going to have to grapple with them in some fashion, that the harms that people identify as part of the right to be forgotten, the right to de-index are real. But so too are the concerns about not allowing large companies to rewrite history, not removing lawful content, and ensuring that we've got full, robust protections around freedom of expression and freedom of access to information.
Michael, thanks for your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Michael Geist, a law professor at the University of Ottawa, specializing in online privacy. That was The Big Story. If you want more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. If you want us to hear more from you, head to our Twitter account at TheBigStoryFPN. You can find us in all our brother and sister shows at frequencypodcastnetwork.com. We keep adding new ones, so go take a look. You will find something you like. And you can rate us and review us wherever you get podcasts. That'd be Apple or Google or Stitcher or Spotify or DinoPod. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath-Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.